From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The petition says that just as colonialism and slavery and apartheid have been delegitimized and outlawed, so war, too, should be outlawed as a social institution for the new century.
Today is UN Day. Peace activists call on the day to be a day without the Pentagon. We'll hear from Judy Collins and a Palestinian-Israeli Sesame Street. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A plunge in the Hong Kong stock market, touched off by an attack on the local currency, shook financial markets around the world yesterday. Stocks lost 10.4% of their value in Hong Kong, causing a frantic sell-off first in Japan and then on Europe stock exchanges when they opened for business. Hours later, Wall Street was engulfed as well. Nerves played a part, as did renewed concerns that stocks in the United States and other markets have risen too far, too fast. Major U.S. allies in Europe and Asia criticized President Clinton's long-awaited plan to curb global warming as weak and ineffectual, claiming it does not measure up to U.S. responsibilities to protect the environment as the world's leading polluter and lone superpower. The skeptical response to Clinton's package of incentives and modest goals, which seeks to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions at 1990 levels between 2008 and the year 2012, reflects the new light in which the world has begun to assess American leadership in the post-Cold War era. In a basic discovery that eventually could lead to powerful new types of AIDS drugs or even a vaccine, researchers have identified in the laboratory a natural molecule that prevents the HIV virus from infecting cells. The molecule was discovered by a team led by famed AIDS researcher Robert Gallo. A report today in the journal Science said the molecule works against HIV by physically blocking the portal used by the virus to invade lymphocytes and other types of blood cells. A group of pregnant women who would have received fake pills in an AIDS drug study in Ethiopia has been dropped from the project, and all of the remaining women will get the real drug, this according to an official at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Mark Kucinich, the spokesperson, says the placebo part of the study planned for Ethiopia was abandoned after a similar study in Thailand by Harvard University was conducted with all participants getting the drug. The Hopkins study and more than a dozen like it have come under heavy criticism because the researchers planned to give AZT to some pregnant women with HIV infection, while others with the disease would get only placebos or fake pills. An underground nuclear waste dump completed nearly a decade ago may soon be getting radioactive garbage following a key approval yesterday by the Environmental Protection Agency. The agency ruled that the repository and salt beds near Carlsbad, about 300 miles southeast of Albuquerque, could safely contain radioactive waste. Environmentalists and others have raised questions for years about pockets of brine below the facility that they say could cause the waste to shift. There also are concerns over nearby mining and drilling, the instability of storage rooms, and the safety of hauling radioactive waste hundreds of miles to the site, about 300 miles from Albuquerque. Pentagon investigators said yesterday they uncovered more than a dozen pages of lost entries from a secret Army document that chronicled efforts to detect Iraqi chemical and biological agents during the Gulf War. The investigation by the Defense Department Inspector General found no evidence of a conspiracy to destroy or conceal the documents, but an Army officer has been put under criminal investigation for taking copies of the entries, the Inspector General said in a report. The officer was not identified. The Pentagon has maintained since the Gulf War that has no evidence that American troops were exposed to harmful levels of chemical agents during the war. Chemical exposure has been suggested by some as a possible explanation for the mysterious ailments suffered by thousands of Gulf War veterans. People who believe U.S. and allied troops were exposed to potentially dangerous levels of Iraqi chemical or biological agents during the 1991 war have speculated that the Pentagon purposely suppressed or destroyed the missing documents. The 20-page document that was found contains 223 entries, mostly notes chronicling the work of chemical and biological agent detection teams in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia during the war and in Iraq and Kuwait after the war ended in February of 1991. The Energy Department spent $50 million on a nuclear waste processing plant in Ohio that was only supposed to cost $16 million. But even before it could handle radioactive materials, the heart of the plant was destroyed in an accident because of poor planning. This according to an independent report. And the Clinton administration has turned over to federal investigators telephone records showing that President Clinton did make telephone calls about campaign fundraising from the White House, including one from the Oval Office and others from his residence. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Activists across the country will be marking a day without the Pentagon today with rallies and protests at major military contractors, recruiters in high schools, universities with military contracts, and war monuments. Sponsored by the pacifist group the War Resisters League, organizers hope to highlight the continued militarization of American society despite the end of the Cold War. At United Nations headquarters in New York City today, where the world body is marking International UN Day, activists will present a women's peace petition of 99,000 signatures to the president of the UN General Assembly. The petition calls for a transfer of funds from military budgets to sustainable development programs. In the next segment of the show, we'll be speaking with Cora Weiss, who is the international representative of Peace Action, and she is also the vice president of the International Peace Bureau. But in this segment of the show, we're going to talk about an event that took place last night at the Tavern on the Green in New York City. It was the 40th anniversary of Peace Action, the nation's largest grassroots peace organization. Cora Weiss was there, as well as William Sloan Coffin, who was one of the heads of Sane Freeze for many years, the precursor to Peace Action. And they awarded a number of honors. Among the people they honored was singer Judy Collins. Jane Alexander presented her with the honor, and then Judy Collins took the mic and talked about her life.
I was raised in a family where we listened to my father's politics were generally liberal and ferociously anti-McCarthy and passionately pro-Sane. And when I was a junior in high school, Steve Allen came to my high school. Do you remember when he first started going around the country talking about Sane? And he spoke, and everyone at East High School, we were the East High Angels. And I had just learned and was singing out on the lawn folk songs. And in fact, I was delighted that my sociology teacher, it was a very, very with-it high school, and this man allowed me anyway, to get credit for sitting out on the lawn singing "This Land Is Your Land." You know, you remember, "This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters." Harmony. "This land was made for you and me." And of course, we grew to understand that it's this world was made for you and me, too. And so from high school, I came with a small detour, but I came to New York. And when I came to New York, I found awaiting me this extraordinary group of people. And so here I found William Sloan Coffin. I also found the wonderful Cora Weiss. In fact, Cora and I, about the time, just around the time that I had decided, you know, sometimes we all become extremely frustrated. And so my thinking always was, yes, the hope that we had in those years when the war kept going on, you know, no one thought. We thought every time we came back from a march, right, Cora? Every time we came back, Bill, from a big event where all of us were together and so many hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people were together, and we thought, that's it. That's the one. That's going to nail it, you know? They're going to stop. How can they not stop? and they wouldn't stop. And so my frustration turned very, very much inward in terms of my music. And it was the year that I had put out Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. And Cora called me up and said, "Do you want to go to France? We'll go and talk to all of the embassies." And so we went to France. There were about 120 of us on this crazy flight to France. Remember? And we were all there together. And Jane went, and we were in this plane, and we went and stayed in France, and we visited the North Vietnamese embassy, the South Vietnamese embassy, and the American embassy. The American embassy wouldn't see us, give us an audience. The South Vietnamese government, I believe, gave us tea, and the North Vietnamese gave us a party. You remember that? And it was there that I began to see there's so many things going on in this dynamic. There's so many people in the world who understand that, you know, it's not us, it's not the guy in the street who wants these wars. It's not you and me. It's not the people generally who vote. It's some other mechanism. And I do believe that it goes on because it has gone on. It's almost like a beast. I had the honor recently to become a UNICEF representative in 1993. Madeleine Albright, who was our representative then, the United Nations ambassador, asked me if I would become involved with UNICEF. I have always been passionate about the United Nations, about the role of peacekeeping in the world, about the need always to keep talking, because I always feel that as long as we're talking, something more can happen, something can happen that would not happen otherwise. And so I was very honored. And the first trip that I made with my husband, Lewis Nelson, who is here tonight, my husband is a designer. He designed the Korean War Memorial in Washington, and he's just now been awarded the job of designing the Dag Hammarskjöld Medal for the United Nations, for the peacekeeping forces. And he's a great artist. In my work with UNICEF, the first thing that I saw was a book called I Dream of Peace. And of course, being so involved for so many years with the peace effort, with the peace movement, with the work that all of us have done, and my darling friend Peter Yarrow is here, and it's so good to see him with us. We've been in a lot of places together. And so I went in 1994, our first trip. My husband was made a U.S. committee representative, and we went to Bosnia on our first trip for UNICEF. And it was there in 1994 that my first experience with landmines came about. I didn't know what a landmine was, and I quickly learned that this machine that has gone on, which has been perpetuated, has created something so ugly, and so it's like an extra nightmare. It's like the nightmare after the nightmare. The perpetuation of landmines and their devastation, according to most experts, will probably go on for 100 years, even if we stop now and do nothing but clean up landmines for 100 years. In Cambodia, that's the way they see it. So I saw 7 and 8-year-olds being educated about landmines, darling little children who had found at that point many, many landmines in that part of the world. Then I went to Vietnam. Lewis and I went to Vietnam in 95. And of course, once again, not only the wonderful work of UNICEF, which is spectacular work and important work, but once again, the problem of landmines. We were on our way to Bosnia. We were in London when Princess Diana died. And I think the day before, the day we were there Saturday, the day of the accident that night, many people in the world didn't know about landmines, and I think that the Monday after her death, many more people knew. It's a strange legacy, but I think that she's helped understand her in her own understanding, helped the world understand about the devastation of landmines. So many people have mourned her death. And there are so many people here who will be helping. I congratulate Jody Williams, of course, and the wonderful Nobel Prize, the International Committee to Ban Landmines, which is an extraordinary triumph. And as you are, so am I, writing and talking to the president and praying to God that, in fact, by the end of the year, we know hope thrives. And we know that this will come to pass, that we join this momentous effort. I wrote a song in my first trip to Bosnia. I think of the children there, of course, of dealing with the wars in these 68 countries, 110 million mines waiting, lying in wait. The war that is the aftershock that will go on, of course, when the civilian conflicts are over, and there are many that go on as we speak, something like 100, I think, is the estimate the United Nations gives. I wrote this song for the children of that country, but it is easily for all children in countries that suffer. Blood in all the streets, running like a flood. There's nowhere to hide, nowhere that I can go. I reach out my hand, touching death itself. Just a holy day in Sarajevo. I can hear my heart pounding like a clock, hiding from the planes and from the bombing. Fire in the sky, burning down my life. There is no more love and no more longing. But when I close my eyes, I dream of peace. I dream of flowers on the hill. I dream I see my mother smiling. When I close my eyes, I dream of peace. Once I had a home, once my life was good. Once my mother sang to me and held me. Then the fire came, falling from the skies. There is no one left who can protect me. War's a wicked bird that never comes to rest, feeding on the dreams of all the children. War's an evil bird, flying in the dark. Every holy promise has been broken. But when I close my eyes, I dream of peace. I dream of flowers on the hill. I dream I see my mother smiling. When I close my eyes, I dream of peace. Can't you stop the war, bring it to a close? You are tall and strong, and I am just a child. Can't we live in peace? Stop the flowing blood. Make a blessed world where I can be a child. When you close your eyes, do you dream of peace? Do you dream of flowers on the hill? Do you dream you see your mother smiling? When you close your eyes, do you dream of peace? When I close my eyes, I dream of peace. I dream of flowers on the hill. I dream I see my mother smiling. When I close my eyes, I dream of peace. Thank you all, and God bless you all for coming tonight.
And that was the singer Judy Collins being honored last night by Peace Action, which was celebrating its 40th birthday. Peace Action, the nation's largest grassroots peace organization. Before that, it was called Sane Freeze. Before that, just Sane. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll continue looking at A Day Without the Pentagon when we return. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Last night, among the people who were at the 40th anniversary event of Peace Action, there was Cora Weiss. She is the international representative of Peace Action, also the vice president of the International Peace Bureau, which was given the Nobel Peace Prize in 1910 for supporting the League of Nations, the precursor to the United Nations. And Cora Weiss has spearheaded a campaign that will present 99,000 signatures to the president of the UN General Assembly today, this on International UN Day. The petition calls for transfer of funds from military budgets to sustainable development programs.
On October 24th, United Nations Day, women are taking the United Nations. We're going to present petitions from 99,000 women from around the world, from 100 countries, to the President of the General Assembly, and the petition calls on all governments of the world to reduce their military budgets across the board by 5% a year for 5 years and transfer that money to create sustainable communities for health, clean water, literacy, job training, which will help women, which will empower women. And at the same time, the petition says that just as colonialism and slavery and apartheid have been delegitimized and outlawed, so war, too, should be outlawed as a social institution for the new century. And we want to put war on the table, on the agenda for discussion. Is war really a necessary institution? You know, people accepted apartheid, people accepted slavery, people accepted colonialism. But there was a struggle against them, against those acceptable institutions that had laws to protect them. And we believe that at the end of the bloodiest century in the history of humankind, it's time to say the time for war to go has come, and we have to think of other institutions and other ways to resolve conflicts. Because the world is awash in weapons, and weapons are for using. And so it's not safe. It's not safe for anyone, whether it's landmines or guns or rifles or tanks or missiles or nuclear bombs. It's simply not safe.
Well, it sounds like it makes a lot of sense, but how much support do you actually have at the United Nations? For example, when you given these petitions today, 99,000 signatures, are there going to be ambassadors with you?
Yes. In fact, the ambassador from Liechtenstein, Claudia Fritschi, is coming. Now, Liechtenstein may be the smallest country on earth, but it's in Europe, and it's an important country. And you know, Liechtenstein got rid of its army in 1860-something. And Claudia is the dean of women at the UN. Now, out of 185 countries, granted, 177 are male dominant, and there are only 8 women ambassadors. But nonetheless, those women are fantastic. They're terrific women. They're very courageous. And Claudia's with us, and the Jamaican ambassador is sending a representative, and the Australians are sending a senator. It's a partnership. This is a partnership between women, what you call non-governmental organizations, I like to call civil society organizations, and governments and the UN structure, because the Department of Public Information of the UN is supporting this project. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to grow. We're going to keep the campaign for signatures going through the year 2000. And we've just gotten these signatures in a couple of months through email and fax and mail. And we don't have a staff and we don't have an organization. It's just been voluntary.
Who came up with this idea?
Well, the idea was initiated by three women, essentially, 6 months ago, as a way of honoring the 50th anniversary of the Commission on the Status of Women. And it's totally appropriate at the end of this terribly war-filled, bloody century for peace to have the last word. And our decision is that the only way to make peace is to start visibly transferring the resources that go into the military, which in many countries of the world outspend programs for education and health, for example. And that's wrong. It's immoral, and it's just plain wrong. So we want to transfer these funds to meet human needs, and we want to say it's time to talk about the abolition, not just of nuclear weapons, but the abolition of war as an institution. We want to delegitimize war.
On this UN Day, what do you think needs to be done at the United Nations to actually move a peace agenda forward?
Well, Kofi Annan, the Secretary General, in his reform package, has proposed that the Disarmament Center be elevated to a Department of Disarmament with the Undersecretary General in charge, which would make disarmament a much more visible and important subject. And after all, the Charter of the UN calls for the United Nations to end the scourge of war. And the first committee of the UN, meaning the most important committee, is the Disarmament Committee. So the UN was born to oppose war and to prevent war. But unfortunately, what's happening now is that more and more emphasis is being put on the humanitarian side, which is important, but it detracts from the peacemaking side. And what we're afraid of is that the United Nations is going to get whittled down into a band-aid operation, an aid operation with small money, small resources. And instead of the UN being the institution to prevent the scourge of war, we're going to see military fortresses built like NATO expansion. And when nations put their money and their political will into expanding NATO, they have to take it away from an institution that really needs support like the United Nations.
Cora Weiss, the International Representative of Peace Action and the Vice President of the International Peace Bureau, explaining the action today on International UN Day, activists presenting a women's peace petition of 99,000 signatures to the President of the UN General Assembly. We wrap up this segment with the songs of Peter Yarrow, who sang last night for the 40th birthday party of Peace Action.
Sword and shield. Down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside, I'm gonna lay down that sword and shield. Down by the riverside, study war no more. I ain't gonna study war no more, ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more.
Well, happy birthday, Peace Action. and you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move into an international subject of war and peace, unfortunately, it has been more on the violent side, and that is the issue of the Middle East and the Israelis versus the Palestinians. The Palestinian Observer Mission at the United Nations has reintroduced an amendment challenging the Israeli government's right to represent the people of the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem in the United Nations. The move has strong backing from developing nations. Just a few days ago, I got a chance to speak with Palestinian-American journalist Daoud Kutab. He heads the Institute for Modern Media at Al-Quds University, based in Ramallah on the West Bank. He's been active around many issues in Israel and the occupied territories and has reported extensively for Pacifica Network News. Democracy Now! Listeners may remember Daoud from several months ago when an international campaign was launched on his behalf after he was arrested by the Palestinian Authority. He was kept in detention for 7 days because he was broadcasting the proceedings of the Palestinian legislature, which were then sharply critical of Palestine Authority President Yasser Arafat. I started by asking him about the situation today and his assessment of what's happening right now in the Middle East, and particularly Israel and the occupied territories.
Well, the situation is quite bleak, Amy. The Palestinian-Israeli negotiators are officially back on track in the sense that they are talking to each other, but there has been very little substantive progress in the talks. The Israelis are still very adamant against stopping settlement activities, and they're very slow in fulfilling the compliance of the agreement, the interim agreement between the Palestinians and the Israelis. They want to jump from the interim agreement to the final status agreement, and there is a lot of skepticism from the Palestinians about that.
What does that mean, to jump from one to the other?
They want to kind of talk about the final status without fulfilling their requirements in the interim status. In the interim agreement, the Israelis were supposed to withdraw from most of the West Bank, and they were supposed to allow free access between West Bank and Gaza and release the prisoners and so on. There now, the Netanyahu government says, well, that can kind of wait, and let's start talking very quickly about the final status and kind of finish that off. And in a way, he wants to eat up some of the requirements that Palestinians think have to be done by kind of jumping the interim period to the final status period.
What about the major embarrassment, as it's called, that the Israeli government suffered in the last few weeks? Can you explain, for listeners who may have not been following it exactly, what happened in Jordan?
Well, after the two suicide bombings that took place in Jerusalem, in which basically Mr. Netanyahu has been embarrassed in that he's failed to produce to the Israeli public the peace and security which he promised. Neither peace nor security was accomplished. And so at one time, or for a long time, they tried to put all the pressure on Arafat, that it's Arafat's fault for not cracking down on Hamas. But at the same time, Netanyahu wanted a kind of exhibitionist type of revenge. He wanted to show the Israeli public that the hands of the State of Israel can reach anybody. And so they concocted a very apparently quickly organized plan to assassinate one of the political leaders of Hamas in Jordan. And they sent a team of agents with some kind of a chemical poisonous medicine to basically shoot up this guy. And the idea was that he wouldn't die immediately. And the idea was that after a couple of days he would die and it would seem like a natural death. Anyway, the bodyguard of this guy, Khaled Mash'al, stopped him, chased him after they had plugged, or they had, I don't know what they did with it, whether it was a laser, whether it was actual a syringe. And he followed these two agents who had false Canadian passports and basically fought with them until the Jordanian police came. And became clear that, the assassination attempt had failed in the sense that they were caught, but the guy was still suffering in a hospital. So the king of Jordan, who's Israel's best Arab friend, was very, very angry, and he demanded an antidote for the poison, and he demanded that the Israelis make gestures towards the Palestinian public, namely to release the leader of Hamas who was held in an Israeli jail.
And the Mossad agents were
caught. And the Mossad agents, in return, were allowed to go back to Israel.
What does all this mean?
Well, It means that the claim of the Netanyahu government that they are not compromising with terrorism, and that they want the Palestinians to crack down and arrest terrorists, kind of becomes expendable when it comes to political allies. That the Israelis had to release their main so-called terrorists, and they had to make compromises with this Islamic group so as to please the Jordanians. At the same time, they're demanding that the Palestinians arrest Islamic individuals for really no specific reason. It just puts a whole hole in the demagogy of Mr. Netanyahu, who keeps talking about terrorism, but when it becomes politically difficult, he also makes compromises.
And this Hamas leader who is in Jordan, what is his relationship to Yasser Arafat?
Well, this Hamas leader is, like the Hamas movement, is a political movement with a military wing that is opposed to the peace process, but not specifically opposed to the political process, or it's not clear what their position is. And there is a lot of hints now that they want to be involved in the political process while still being opposed to the Oslo process.
And now let's talk about what you're doing in the West Bank. We often deal with the latest news out of Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, but don't often look at the infrastructure on the ground. You are the head of something called the Institute for Modern Media, which does what?
Well, our institute is the first of its kind. It is has a two-track approach. On the one hand, we're trying to train young Palestinians in the most modern media, whether it's television, cinema, or the internet, and the various multimedia aspects. At the same time, we have a kind of a community relations wing, which is our TV station. We have an educational TV station that tries to allow students to work, and it becomes like a public TV station. And so we're working on both these aspects, training people on the one hand, and mostly we're training people involved in private TV and radio stations.
Now, you got into some trouble a couple months ago when you decided to start broadcasting the proceedings of the Palestinian legislature. What caused the controversy?
Well, the Palestinian legislature had been elected about a year and a half ago. And in the first year of their operation, the official Palestinian TV and radio completely ignored them, apparently from orders from Arafat and his people.
Why?
The executive didn't really want to give the legislatures a lot of power, and so they did not cover their proceedings. Even though their sessions were open to the public, very few people heard about them. And so we, because we were a public station and we were filming all kinds of seminars and events and public meetings, we decided to start broadcasting the event of the legislature in a live and unedited broadcast. And the legislatures were very happy because people were for the first time starting to see them in action. People were very happy with that. But we started facing problems. Our broadcast was jammed by the official TV station, and later I was arrested.
And what were they talking about in the Palestinian legislature? What were the issues they were debating that Yasser Arafat did not want out there?
They had debated many issues. They had presented a lot of laws that they wanted to be passed, that they had passed, but they wanted the president to sign, which he wasn't signing. And there was a major controversy, which was like a we call a corruption scandal, where there was a lot of, for the first time, Palestinian legislatures were presented with a budget. And there was a lot of problems with the budget. And they were talking about this in publicly, about the monopolies, about some ministers who had three homes and like four cars and very high phone bills and so on. And so we had broadcast that. Not only that, we started making copies of our tapes and giving them to the many new TV stations that have been kind of mushrooming in the West Bank. This didn't please many people.
So you were arrested, and what happened? Yasser Arafat put you where?
Well, the local police called me in and basically held me for 7 days, apparently on orders from President Arafat. I was never questioned, interrogated. There was never a charge sheet opened against me. So I was never told why I was arrested, and I was after a lot of uproar, I was released. But it was quite clear that it had connections to the Legislative Council being aired.
The U.S. Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, got involved with your detention, didn't she?
Yes, she was among many people who demanded my release, including many Palestinian cabinet ministers and people in the Legislative Council, and journalists and Palestinian intellectuals. So there was a lot of people who were involved in this issue.
Now, this was before she got involved directly with the peace process, but she made a call to Arafat.
Well, the time I was arrested was a time when the Palestinians were quite frustrated with the U.S. position on the peace process. Madeleine Albright had been in office for 6 months by that time. She had visited almost every country that had any conflict except the Middle East. And they were making demands or requests of the U.S. to raise the level of their involvement in the Middle East. And Mrs. Albright was against that at the time. But when I was arrested, I'm not sure why, because I'm an American citizen or whatever, she became quite personally involved, and she initiated a call to President Arafat and demanded my immediate release. And friends of mine who were in the room at the time, President Arafat refused to take the call, but apparently he kept on commenting on the fact that she kept on saying, "I want Daoud Qutab released immediately." And this kind of arrogant approach caused Arafat to kind of say, "Okay, we'll show her how long immediately will be." And apparently I stayed in jail for a few more days because of that word.
So much of the exercising authority by a superpower.
Daoud Qutab, he's a Palestinian journalist, head of the Institute for Modern Media. We'll be back with him here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a minute.
Talking to Daoud Qutab, who is the head of the Institute for Modern Media in Ramallah on the West Bank, also a Pacifica reporter for many years, and you may be familiar with him if you've listened to the Pacifica Network News. You mentioned other TV and radio stations on the West Bank. Can you tell us how many there are and how they operate?
One of the main advantages that the peace process has produced was that for the first time in Palestinian history, we as Palestinians had control, sovereign control over the major cities, populated areas. And also when the Israelis withdrew, they took away with them their huge transmitters that they had stuck in the Palestinian areas. So here was a situation where there was a vacuum of information. The people in the various cities did not have access to TV stations. And there was an opportunity to establish local private TV stations. And within 2 years, we had 19 TV stations and a few radio stations come up by private individuals, journalists, sometimes business people, who tried to fill in the vacuum that was left. The Palestinian Authority, while not having the international power to give out licenses, basically gave permits for these stations to operate. And we had this fortune of having all these stations that wanted to really be involved in media work. They were privately owned, independent, and while not partisan to any particular political group, they often quickly made alliances with local government leaders. And these local government leaders quickly became their advocates. So at one time, there was an attempt to close all these stations. The local mayors and governors.
By
people from the official Palestinian TV or people in the executive, the mayors and governors went to Arafat and pleaded for the case of these private stations. Also, there was...
Why would he want them closed?
They wanted them closed because they felt that they weren't under control and that they basically were doing things that they might not like. They weren't sure, but they were afraid.
Was there a lot of political discussion on these stations?
There wasn't a lot. These were not revolutionary stations, but they were owned and controlled by private individuals who were, who opened up the telephone lines and people were able to call, and they covered local news, and at times they were critical of certain events. But by and large, they were not political stations. They ran, TV programs and local news. But still, for people in the Palestinian Authority who were quite new in the issue of governance, they were a bit afraid. You know, in the whole Arab world, except for Lebanon, there are no private TV or radio stations. So it's not surprising that they would be worried about them. But this connection with the local government was a kind of a way out for them. There was another reason why the Palestinian Authority allowed these stations to go on, which is the fear that the official station might be closed if there was trouble between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And that really happened after the bombings. Mr. Netanyahu's government threatened to close down or to jam the official stations. So to have many local stations was seen as a kind of a possible help in the case of an emergency, a national emergency.
Could he have jammed?
They could have jammed if they had the equipment. Apparently, after making those announcements, they discovered that most of the jamming equipment, obviously, is run by the Israeli radio and TV stations, which refused to participate in this jamming exercise.
Now, something we've heard about broadcasting in Israel and the West Bank is the story about Sesame Street that has gotten a lot of attention that you've been very involved with. But I think it's really instructive about how you can take control over something and use it to benefit, in your case, the Palestinians. Can you explain how this has taken place? Is it on the air yet?
No, it's not on the air. It'll be on the air in April. What has happened is that Israel, in general, has a very powerful media instrument. They have very powerful transmitters, radio and TV, and they have a lot of money invested in media. And so the Israeli media is quite powerful. They not only have media in Hebrew for the Israeli public, but they also have Arabic language media. And while it's clear that this is a propagandist tool, it's still a very powerful tool and many people listen to it. And yet in the history of the State of Israel's Arabic programming, they never designed any programming with authentic Palestinian content. In other words, even programming that was done in Arabic was written by Israeli writers in Hebrew and then translated to Arabic. And so the content was always not very authentic. So when the people of the Children's Television Workshop came to the Middle East and wanted to do an Israeli-Palestinian version of Sesame Street, they approached me and other people, and after some initial hesitation, we agreed to participate in this project because we felt it would be a real political breakthrough to have Palestinian characters written and represented by Palestinians.
If you could get them written,
if we could get them done that. And that was basically my condition, that we would participate in an Israeli-Palestinian project so long as it's not a tokenistic project, that we didn't want Palestinians just to be a token, that a kind of a nice Israeli program with a few Palestinians just for decor. We wanted to be authentically represented. So we demanded that whatever was going to be done had to be done, written and directed and produced and the puppeteers moved by Palestinians. And of course, they agreed to that. But at the same time, we told them that since we didn't have that kind of experience and talent and tradition, that the Americans had to help us raise the level of skill and the craft among Palestinians so that they can do that. And they agreed. And they invested a lot of money into the training. We had fellowships here in New York. We had writers like Josh Selig and others come from the States and be resident producers in Jerusalem and worked with our writers and with our producers. And we were able to produce Palestinian segments that were really authentic, and they came out to be very good.
So are there going to be Israeli and Palestinian kids on Sesame Street?
There will be Sesame Street will be two streets. It will be an Israeli street with Israeli characters and Israeli puppeteers and puppets and Israeli scenery, kind of a Tel Aviv kind of a scene. And there will be a Palestinian street, which we call Shara Simpson, which will have Palestinian puppets who speak Arabic and who live in Arab homes and eat Arab sweets. And the look and the taste and the movement is clearly Palestinian. And there are times where they intermingle and they meet each other.
That the kids will meet and meet each other.
The kids and the puppets would meet each other. And then we designed basically what we call bridges, bilingual characters who speak both Arabic and Hebrew and who act like translators between the two sides.
So you have Palestinian Ernie and Bertz?
We have Karim and Hanin, this Palestinian rooster and a Palestinian kind of a doll, a puppet like Zoe a little bit. Mm-hmm. And there's, of
big
course,
bird? Israelis.
No, there's no big bird.
What about what you're doing on the internet? That's very interesting to take a tab.
Yes, we received a grant from Soros Foundation to create on the internet Arabic language content. And we started through the organization Internews, a kind of Internews Middle East branch, where we concentrated on trying to connect Palestinian journalists with each other, to train journalists and to provide content on the internet in Arabic. And basically, we call this project Amin, the Arabic Media Internet Network. And the word Amin in Arabic means faithful. And what we try to do is be very faithful to the content of what the journalists were writing by mirroring whatever they were writing on the internet so that people can see what is written about themselves in other countries. And the reason we did that is we discovered that in the Arab world, the Arab press is very free and open about the writings of all the countries in the Arab world except their own. And so the idea was if we would put all the Arab press on one home page, you can really find out much more in an honest way, in a censorship-free way, what was going on. This has been now followed up with a chat program, which is the first of its kind, a chat program in Arabic. Using the Java software, we're able to allow people from different parts of the world who are not who want to write and type in Arabic to be able to communicate.
But I don't understand, how does that work? Because we don't have letters in our computer that are Arabic letters.
Well, you have on your computer, on your where you type,
keyboard.
Now, when you enter this, it tells you that the letter L in English sounds like the letter whatever in Arabic.
So you write, you hit L, and it hits a different letter.
It comes out to a different letter. And, of course, in our computers in the Middle East, we have both L, let's say, in English and Aleph in Arabic. So we know that when we put Arabic mode, that we can type things in Arabic. So most people who are proficient in typing in Arabic know where the letters are. And those who don't can download from the computer a kind of a chart which tells you where the letters are.
If people want to engage in the Arabic chat room online, where do they go?
They go to this to our webpage called www.amin.org. And from there, they can look up newspapers, they can look up the chat, they can look up. We have a phone directory of Middle Eastern press connections. So if you want to write to a newspaper, if you want the phone number of Hanan Ashrawi, if you want to interview, I don't know who. We have all these people's phone numbers, faxes, email addresses on the internet. So you can look that up in English.
The newspapers are also translated into English?
No. Some that are in English are put in English, like the Jordan Times. You can see it in English. And those that are in Arabic are put in Arabic.
Is there anything you'd like to add about what you're doing and your plans are for the Institute for Modern Media in Ramallah?
Yes. We are quite concerned about, obviously, raising the level of both the equipment that we have and the quality of people that we have. And we're one of the reasons I'm here in the States is to try to drum up financial support to be able to improve our equipment and to try to raise money for certain programming. Like I want to do a program called The Fourth Estate, which is something like what FAIR does, Fairness and Accuracy in Democracy in Reporting. And also, we're trying to prepare a kind of a summer program in connection with major American university where people can come to Palestine, to Jerusalem, and spend 3 weeks learning about the situation, but also with the eye on the media to kind of train in the media field. And, you know, the Middle East is one of the hottest news spots, so they can actually practice their media work by going and doing a story. But this way we will benefit in the sense that people can stay at our institute and train, and at the same time they can try to learn more about the Middle East.
I thought it was interesting when I heard you speak a few nights ago, the point you made when you first realized how much training had to be done amongst Palestinians to start getting news from a Palestinian perspective. And you described how it worked through the Intifada when U.S. or other international reporters would come, particularly TV reporters, and hire Israeli crews.
Yeah, we discovered that there was, in the beginning of the Intifada, more than 3,000 Israeli camera people and producers who were basically working for foreign networks. And it was very ironic because Israelis have to, young men have to spend 1 month a year in the army. And so imagine a camera person who is an Israeli would have to shoot with a Betacam camera for 11 months and 1 month comes to the same location, shoots with a gun. And so we thought that it was a bit strange, and we wanted many of these producers to use local talent, especially at times when Israelis would close off areas and nobody could get in. Whereas if you were living in that area and you had a camera, you had a big advantage. And many of the producers were interested and willing, but they didn't have any talented or trained Palestinians.
Did the Israeli intelligence also use some of these crews to gather intelligence?
By and large, I don't have, you know, any political complaints about these people. I mean, what I was saying is more of a theoretical issue. But the Israelis did at times use the press, use signs, journalists, to cover up intelligence people who wanted to infiltrate certain areas.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And if people want to get in touch with the Institute for Modern Media in Ramallah, where can they call?
They can call in Palestine using a country code 972.
So that's 011-972.
011-972-995-9273. They want to send an email. They can use my email address at dkuttab, D-K-U-T-T-A-B, at amin, A-M-I-N dot org. They can also call our contact in the U.S., Betsy Mayfield. Her number is 212-307-6144.
And your email address again?
My email address is dkuttab, D-K-U-T-T-A-B, at amin.org.
Palestinian reporter Daoud Kuttab, he heads the Institute for Modern Media in Ramallah on the West Bank. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineer in New York, Michael G. Haskins. Our engineer in Washington, Andy York. Leslie George is our director. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be right back.